The headlines: Iran's President Raisi meets with Turkmenistan's President Berdi Muhammadov as he arrives in Ashgabat to attend the summit of Caspian Littoral States. Another Palestinian killed by Israeli gunfire. Military forces shoot him in the chest during a raid on the town of Jenin. Plus, hunger reaching new peaks in Yemen as the UN warns well above 19 million people are going hungry. Our top story for this half hour. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is in Turkmenistan's capital Ashgabat to attend the sixth summit of the Caspian Sea Littoral States. Upon arrival a short while ago, he met with Turkmenistan's President Serdar Berdi Muhammadov. In a speech in Tehran ahead of his departure, President Raisi said one of the key topics to be discussed will be preventing the presence of foreign forces in the Caspian Sea region. He also talked about plans to boost cooperation in transit trade and environmental preservation. The legal status of the Caspian Sea will also be high on the agenda. The coastlines of the resource-rich sea are legally divided among five littoral states, namely Azerbaijan, Iran, Kazakhstan, Russia, and Turkmenistan. A day ahead of the summit, the Russian foreign minister stressed the need to speed up work on an agreement to reinforce military cooperation in the Caspian Sea. Sergei Lavrov said the sides have already reaffirmed that the presence of armed forces of non-Caspian states in the region is out of the question. Well, talks to remove anti-Iran sanctions have resumed, this time in the Qatari capital, Doha. Iran's foreign minister says an agreement will be within reach if Washington shows serious willingness to conclude a deal and act realistically. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said U.S. President Joe Biden has sent several messages to Iran saying he is serious in making a deal, but Tehran has so far seen no action. He said what Tehran has seen is merely the continuation of an anti-Iran pressure campaign designed by the former U.S. administration. Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready to strike a firm and lasting agreement and it won't cross its red lines. Iran says all sanctions reinstated after the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal should be lifted in a verifiable manner. The top negotiators from Iran and the United States are in the Qatari capital for indirect talks over the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Earlier in our news review program, our guests offered their perspectives on the upcoming negotiations and whether the Doha talks will yield results.
Time now for the news review section. Talks kick off in the Qatari capital over the revival of the 2015 deal, which was left in limbo following the 2018 U.S. withdrawal from the accord and reimposition of sanctions on Iran. Iranian top negotiator Ali Bagharikani has met with the European Union's coordinator, Enrique Mora. The EU envoy is in Doha to facilitate the indirect talks between Bagheri and U.S. negotiator Robert Malley. The negotiations will be held within the framework of the Vienna talks that were stalled in March this year over what Tehran called Washington's excessive demands. Iran says that the Doha talks will focus on the remaining issues about the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions. It's emphasized that nothing will be added to or deducted from the agreements already reached in Vienna. Tehran says any future deal must guarantee that Iran will benefit economically from the 2015 accord, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Let me now invite a couple of guests and get some insight and contribution from their side. So joining me will be Said Mustafa Khoshesh. He's a journalist and political analyst in Tehran. Also with us will be Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Marseille in France. Elijah has been moving around recently. Now let's go to Mustafa first. So this time around, Iran, as you know, is stressing we have nothing to do with what is already agreed upon in Vienna. We're only focusing on sanctions removal. So do you think that this time around the U.S. has come to its senses and really something positive will come out of this round of negotiations in Doha?
Hello, Behrouz, and thanks for having me. Well, You know, when Joseph Borrell was in Tehran, his initiative just focused on the forum. He tried to give some kind of impetus to the talks, to bring it back to international events, to resume meetings, to see if there could be a chance for progress in content. But we've not seen any kind of change in the contents of the talks. You know, Iran and the United States have been left with a few issues that mostly include removal of sanctions on Iranian firms, entities, and bodies and companies under the red list of sanctions since March, and they've been at a war of willpower for the past 3 months. Since last month, Americans have started some kind of hostile moves against Iran in a hybrid warfare. After Iran presented its initiative to Mr. Mora in Tehran, he was happy. And back to Europe, Joseph Borrell was also happy, since they imagined that there could be some kind of progress in the talks. But they were upset after they received a negative response of the United States over removal of sanctions on a number of, you know, firms, entities, and individuals. One of the main issues here, alongside the removal of sanctions, is guarantees, which is very much needed, considering that Americans were the ones who left the JCPOA very irresponsibly, and the EU failed to make up for the lost part despite their promises to Tehran. And after Iran stayed under the deal with full implementation for 14 months, they did nothing, zilch. Now, it's very rational and logical for Tehran or any other actor to demand for guarantees if the U.S. means to return to the JCPOA. And especially considering that Republicans are very much vocal in their opposition to the JCPOA and deal with Tehran, and they are about to win the majority in a few months from now in the U.S. Senate and House. Once they win the majority there, then they would definitely torpedo any kind of deal with Tehran.
Elijah, some people believe that this is flogging a dead horse. 1 minute, please.
There are 90 pages that have been agreed in Vienna, including everything that Iran wanted. So we're not going to go through that. Yes, the Americans can offer a guarantee if they can respect it. They're not going to respect, they're not going to offer something they cannot hold on to and they cannot respect. So this is why Iran understand, and I think I feel very positive of what's happening in Doha, because it is not going to come out with a final solution, but it's the beginning of taking the knots out, and that is a good start after several weeks of suspension.
Okay, Mostafa Khoshchashm in Tehran, Elijah Magnier in Marseille. Thank you so much for the contribution and insight.
Moving on, Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian man during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Mohammed Maher Marai died in hospital after being shot in the chest by the regime's troops. Another Palestinian was injured during the confrontation. Israeli forces have also detained a total of 20 Palestinians as they stormed different neighborhoods across Jenin and Silwad since the early morning. Jenin has been a focal point of Israeli attacks in recent months. More than 20 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in and around the refugee camp since the beginning of the year. Our correspondent Mona Kandil tells us why the Israeli forces attack the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on an almost daily basis.
As you have mentioned, Mohammed Marai is not the first Palestinian who was killed by the Israeli forces in Jenin. The Israeli military, and according to experts, of course, that in recent months when Palestinians carried out anti-Israel operations, many of them originally came from Jenin area. That's why the Israelis are trying to show the Israeli street, the Israelis and the settlers themselves as well, that the military is not silent, that the Israeli military continue to chase Palestinian, they call terrorists, and raid Jenin area almost on a daily basis.
Elbit Systems, an Israel weapons manufacturer, is being drummed out of the UK. It has already been forced to close down its headquarters in London, and activists are not stopping there. Bianca Raimi tells us more in this report.
A potential choice for the UK competition, which
Elbit Systems markets its weaponry as battle-tested, and this is what it means. The Gaza Strip has become a showroom for Israel's deadly arms trade. While the death toll is counted, Israel uses footage to advertise its products, signing multi-million dollar contracts as a result. One of its customers is Britain, which also hosts Elbit factories. Palestine Action has successfully closed down its headquarters in London and in Oldham, and is now going after UAV, which makes end for Elbit's military drones.
Nestled in the British countryside, a factory producing weapons to be used against the Palestinians in the Middle East. So are the locals aware of what's going on here? The activists protesting here today say yes. And they also say momentum is building across the country in support of Palestine Action.
I think local community, until we started demonstrating here, were not aware what this company is doing. As a result of our protests, a lot more people are learning what this company is doing, and they are not actually supportive of it.
I came back from Bristol not long ago and I had a Shut Elbit Down t-shirt on, and every child in the housing estate I was walking through started to chant it. They all knew who Elbit was. Now, when I was young, nobody knew really anything about the Palestinian, they didn't really know what was happening.
The protesters also say that as Britons, they have a heightened responsibility to oppose the Israeli entity and fight for the liberation of Palestine.
We created this situation before even Britain had conquered that country. We gave it away to people who didn't live there.
One of the most interesting things, and I don't know if many people know this, the British Parliament in the 30s took a decision that there should be a representative assembly, as they did with their colonial, and that would have been a majority for the Palestinians. And the Labour Party, who were very, very strong supporters of Zionism, objected to that, and it was eventually defeated.
It was found out by, I think, CAT, a campaign against the arms trade, that 164 children died directly from drones made in the UK. And this factory makes drones, makes weaponized drones, which makes them ammunition, which means this is a weapons factory. There's often an argument, are they weapons, are they not? Yes, they are, they're weaponized, and they're classified as munitions. So, yeah, it's got to go.
The UK is said to be using Israeli weapons to stop refugees from reaching its shores. But in Britain, there is a colossal pushback against any cooperation with Tel Aviv. Millions of people regularly march in support of the Palestinian people, calling for an end to apartheid and for Israel to be held accountable for its crimes against humanity. Bianca Rahimi, Shenstone.
Widespread starvation is looming on the horizon as the United Nations has slashed its funding for war-ravaged Yemen. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says over 19 million people are going hungry in Yemen. The figure is the highest since the start of the Saudi-led war on the impoverished country. According to the UN Children's Agency, about 2.3 million children are also suffering from acute malnutrition, as Yemenis scrambling to get enough food due to 8 years of Saudi-led war and famine. Riyadh's military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. World Food Program currently provides food aid to 13 million Yemenis. But the agency has announced drastic cuts, meaning only 5 million of them will be able to access the assistance. Rami Arsano correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washali says UN decision to cut aid could prove catastrophic for war-torn Yemen.
And this is a catastrophic decision, actually, as most of the people in this country depend on aid to survive, and they will now have no food to eat, and the situation will get much worse even than the situation in the past years as the Saudi coalition has been bombing. And the observers here believe that this decision is being politically pushed by the Saudi coalition's countries, and they believe that these countries are funding actually the United Nations and using this world body to push maybe some political on the decisions on the forces in Sana'a and the Sana'a government. And the international community did nothing for the Yemeni people during 7 years of war, but rather now they are cutting off some aid from the Yemeni people, and the situation will be catastrophic. We will see children die, as we have 2.3 million children suffering from acute malnutrition. They have no enough food for themselves.
Fighting rages on in eastern Ukraine, where the Russian military is pressing ahead with its operation to take the Donbas region. Over the weekend, Russia took control of the commercial hub of Severodonetsk, and now it's pushing to seize its twin city, Lysychansk, where the governor says the situation is very difficult. Our correspondent Johnny Miller in Donetsk has the latest.
The Russian army at the moment, they say they've taken about a third of Lysychansk. It is of course the twin city of Severodonetsk. That battle went on for a couple of weeks there. It looks like this battle for Lysychansk won't take as long. It looks like the Russians inevitably will take it. Much of the Ukrainian army has withdrawn, but they are putting up still a fierce resistance in that city. But it looks like only a matter of time until the Russians do take it. Then what will happen? It looks like the Ukrainians, they're determined to fight for every inch of Donbass. So it looks like they'll retreat to more defensive lines. Of course, the cities is where the Ukrainians have most success defending against the Russians in open ground, even in trenches now. With the overwhelming Russian artillery and air superiority, the Ukrainians don't stand much of a chance. So it's in the cities they stand, they're able to put up a better defense. So there's the towns of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. They may well retreat to those towns after Lysychansk, but it looks like it is only a matter of time until the Russians take that city.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. As for his personal traits, a magnanimous Imam was an exemplary personality in the true sense of the word. He was real exemplary. His personal characteristics were such that few personalities could have all together. I do not know any personality in our history who had all these characteristics together. First of all, he was pure and pious. Imam was a pious, pure and moral personality in the literal sense of the word. Secondly, he was a man of spiritual and mystical sentiments. He was interested in spiritual and mystic feelings. He would cry at dawn. The late Haj Ahmad Agha said to me that the kerchief that he had for crying at dawn during the daily and other prayers would not suffice, and they had to put a towel so that he would be able to wipe his hands and face. He was a man of such a spiritual status. He was a man of spiritual delicacy. His spiritual books, the manners of daily prayers, and commentary on the hadith on wisdom and ignorance were written during his middle age. When he was around 40 years, he was like this since his youth. Imam combined valor and mysticism. He was both a man of epics and of spirituality.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
He was morally brave in the true sense of the word. Imam has been quoted as saying, "I myself did not hear this. By God, I have never feared. What I myself heard him say was in a meeting with him over a certain matter. I had a suggestion about a problem, and I said to him, 'You do not do this because you are afraid of...' I wanted to finish the sentence by saying, 'Because you are afraid that such and such a problem would occur.' But as soon as I said, 'Because you are afraid,' he answered, 'I'm not afraid of anything.' This was his characteristic. 'I did not want to say you're scared.' This is a common expression meaning you are concerned that something might happen. However, I used the term afraid. He answered, 'I'm not afraid of anything.' He was courageous in the true sense of the word. He enjoyed acumen and wisdom. He was a man of making careful calculations. He would not do things without calculating them first. And when he reached a result in that calculation, he would put it into action with complete decisiveness.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Strikes in Europe's transport sector have disrupted air flights and train schedules as transportation companies struggle to cope with rising demand at the start of the peak of summer travel season after COVID restrictions were lifted. A strike by staff members at Irish Airline, Ryanair, and Brussels Airlines over pay and working conditions forced the cancellation of many flights. The workers' strike also disrupted flight schedules in Spain, Italy, France, Portugal, and Belgium. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the British railway system once again came to a halt. Tens of thousands of workers have walked in Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years, with millions of passengers facing days of chaos as both the unions and the government have stuck to their guns in a row over pay. The British Transport Union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, RMT, threatened to continue the industrial action until managers address the workers' grievances and meet their salary demands. According to the UK government career service, RMT members who are not high earners, for example train guards and track maintenance staff, earn somewhere between £20,000 to £35,000. But the union says its members deserve more. Despite the ongoing negotiations between representatives from the management and staff, the media predicted the strikes to continue. They attributed further industrial action to the rapidly rising inflation rates exacerbated by sluggish economic growth, saying this combo will likely lead to more worker strikes across the European continent in the summer ahead.
The people who are on strike have been pretty clear about it, including in Great Britain with the railroads, the airline pilots, and everybody else. For some years, they've been in trouble and there have been increasing social unrest. And what's happening now is a huge increase in inflation and hence a decrease in purchasing power, and people's standard of living is going down. And so you're having a confluence of events. You have this economic crisis, then you have this people saying, listen, we cannot let the war in Ukraine completely derail the environmental crisis. And furthermore, the policies, as another group saying, look, the policies that we're pursuing, that our governments are pursuing in Ukraine, are adding to the problem, not making it better.
Unions have said the rail strikes could mark the start of a summer of discontent, with teachers, medics, and even waste disposal workers heading for industrial action as inflation pushes 10%. Inflation has soared across Europe on the back of a major rise in energy costs, and Britain is not alone in facing strikes. Russia's war in Ukraine pushed the already rising inflation in countries that use the euro to a record high in May, with energy projected to have the steepest annual rate. As the war in Ukraine drags on through its fourth month, the West, led by US and NATO, remains largely united in backing Kiev, but they are divided over how long they're willing to endure the conflict's economic fallout. The prospect of a drawn-out conflict with the battle raging in eastern Ukraine has raised questions about whether war fatigue, coupled with skyrocketing food prices and energy bills, could test countries' political will to keep pressuring Moscow over time. In the US, President Joe Biden blamed the Russians for rising US gas prices, saying it was outrageous what the war in Ukraine is causing. Hungary, on the other hand, has called for immediate peace talks to end the war between Ukraine and Russia, warning that a prolonged conflict will fuel an economic crisis that will imperil governments across Europe. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned of an unprecedented global hunger crisis in light of the recent developments.
There's a couple of different things going on here. There is the United States as an outlier in NATO in a certain sense, with some of the Eastern European companies really pushing for more and more aggressive behavior by NATO in Ukraine. You have other countries which are in Western Europe who are suffering from the United States activities here, the real pressure economically, and are beginning to say, wait a minute, this is not what we really want to have here. Our population's getting upset. And then you have apparently the failure of the sanctions. And in the United States press, at least, the understanding that maybe they're not going to work so well. And so the Russians are not going to be suffering so much.
Western countries rallied around Kiev when Russia began its military operation in Ukraine in February. But now that unity is being tested as soaring inflation and energy shortages rebound on their own citizens. Now, the UN Human Rights Office agrees that the veteran Palestinian journalist was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her colleague were targeted by seemingly well-aimed bullets as they covered a military raid in the occupied West Bank.
all the information we have gathered, including official documentation from the Israeli military and the Palestinian Attorney General, is consistent with the finding that the shots that killed Abu Akleh and injured her colleague came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians, as was initially claimed by the Israeli authorities.
So far, several media organizations have conducted their own investigations into the incident, and all have come to the same conclusion. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probe, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the fingers at Israel from the outset. The UN has also confirmed that Abu Akleh was wearing a blue flak jacket marked with the word press when being shot by Israeli troops, exposing the gruesome nature of the daylight murder and suggesting that they were deliberately targeted.
As long as the United States and its allies continue to not only embrace this position, but to promote this position using every tactic at their disposal, including threats, the more that has been the case, the more the occupation is quite happy to resort to war crimes bordering on what one could also say are crimes against humanity, albeit in a very calculated move, drawn out over a period of decades, as is the case with ethnic cleansing, which if it happened over a shorter period of time, would fit very nicely with the definition of a genocide.
The killing of yet another journalist is, however, in line with the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. Israeli brutality against Palestinians and journalists has been a topic of discussion for many years now. The regime has, however, never accepted blame for its wrongdoing, and in nearly all cases baselessly shifted the blame on Palestinians, and the case of Abu Akleh is no exception. Following the UN's report, the Israeli regime insisted that the fatal shooting of Abu Akleh was unintentional, pointing out at the same time that it had not received access to critical evidence that might determine whether she was killed by an Israeli soldier or a Palestinian gunman. Israel's military also says Palestinian authorities should hand over the bullet that killed Shireen. The demand has, however, been met by widespread criticism, with Palestinians saying the regime should hand over the gun which is believed to have killed the journalist, as Israel can't be trusted of conducting a fair investigation of itself. The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel for its occupation and blockades of the coastal enclave. Yet, no one, including the UNSC, has used any of its tools to ensure resolutions related to ending the Israeli siege imposed on Gaza have been implemented.
The complete lack of accountability only encourages, as we have seen, more war crimes by the occupation. And the unfortunate that the position long taken by the number one sponsor of the occupation, the United States of America, is that Palestinians and Israelis should resolve their differences through negotiation, and in both instances should be prevented from invoking international law and the institutions which administer it in order to impose a solution in keeping with their respective legal obligations in the so-called rules-based international order. And that, of course, is really quite absurd.
Instead, many of the UNSC member states have doubled their support for Israel, despite its blockade and bombardment of Gaza and murdering dozens of innocent women and children. Some even increased their support for the regime and obliged neighboring countries to forge ties with it. And in absence of action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against the Palestinians, whether a journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon. Thank you.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war. The Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed. All of the NATO bases. It will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences. Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
Iran has released fresh details about the covert and planned operations of agents of Israeli spy agency in Iran. Officials say the three agents detained back in April were planning to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. Officials say the agents were arrested following a complicated intelligence operation that lasted 8 months. Judiciary officials say some members of the cell have been arrested in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, while other members and operatives have been detained outside the province by Iran's intelligence forces.
Officials say the case is under preliminary investigation and that an indictment would be filed and sent to court soon. This is not the first time Iran busts Mossad-linked terrorists. In July last year, Iran's intelligence ministry arrested a network of agents with the Israeli Mossad spy agency at the western borders, confiscating a large cache of weapons and ammunition that they were planning to use to provoke riots and terror inside the country.
Well, of course there should be, and I don't think anyone is really going to seriously say it's unthinkable that Israel would try to assassinate Iranian figures, whether in science or politics. They've got a demonstrable propensity to do so, and they boast about it.
The arrests come amid open threats by Israeli officials against Iranian nuclear scientists and facilities. The regime is notorious for its sabotage activities and assassinations in Iran.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran and a very open hostility is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Israel has tried various ways to stop Iran's nuclear progress. They include acts of sabotage, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as threats to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Probably the most high-profile assassination was the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist who was brutally murdered by Mossad agents in 2020. Mossad was involved in an explosion that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in 2021. Israel was also the main regional force that pushed the United States to exert economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. The policy culminated in the so-called maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump. But none of those policies reached their stated goals. Iran's economy did not collapse, and its nuclear program has accelerated massively after the U.S. quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2018.
It's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something greater. It carries out assassinations, there's no question about that. It carries out bombings inside the country, carried out by covert agents. I think right now the United States government is not wishing to see an escalation into a full-blown war. And Israel does, in the final analysis, have to pay attention to what Washington thinks and says.
Just recently, a top U.S. think tank admitted to Israel's failure towards Iran. A report by Atlantic Council said that Israel's policy has failed to stop Iran. The article said the Tel Aviv regime needs to recalculate and adopt a strategy that corresponds to the current state of the Iranian nuclear program. Given the current state of affairs, the United States, which is Israel's staunch ally, needs to reconsider its unilateral support for Israel.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن لله في كل نعمة حقا فمن أداه زاده منها ومن قصر فيه خاطر بزوال نعمته.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "Surely in every blessing there is a right of Allah. If one discharges that right, Allah increases the blessing. And if one falls short of doing so, one stands in danger of losing the blessing."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, in the various programs that we have had regarding the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we have learned that Imam Ali's life included and was very much involved in knowledge. Of course, Islam is the religion of knowledge, Quran is the religion of knowledge, and the Almighty Allah is the source of knowledge. And so likewise, the Holy Prophet taught us knowledge. He was the completion of human knowledge. Now, of course, as Imam Ali alayhi salam is the living miracle of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, Imam Ali being the living miracle, we see that the Holy Prophet taught Imam Ali all this kind of
vast ocean of knowledge. But Imam Ali alayhi salam says something very interesting. He says that knowledge is belief which is acted upon. It is so interesting, dear friends, and sometimes it is actually rather unfortunate. And at one point or the other, we are all victims to this mishap or this flaw, if you want to call it. And what flaw is that, dear friends? That flaw is that we do not act upon the knowledge that we have. It is really interesting, but Ayatollah Taqi Behjat said that if you act upon what you know, Allah will teach you what you do not know. And so here we find that Amir al-Mu'mineen, the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, tells us that knowledge, true knowledge, is belief which is acted upon. If we do not act upon what we know, we will move farther and farther away from the path of truth and justice. And if we act upon what we know, we will continue to walk the path of truth and justice. But we must hope and pray, and we must request Allah the Almighty, that if for some reason we are not able to fully act upon our knowledge, may Allah help us and endow us with the power and the strength and the courage and the determination to act upon what we know. And if, by the grace and favor of the Almighty Allah, we do act upon what we know, we pray to Allah that may Allah help us to always remain steadfast and to help us always act upon what we know. A very profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاجعل نفسي مطمئنة بقدرك راضية بقضائك.
O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. He was born inside the place that billions face in prayer. He was martyred in one of the best places of prayer whilst performing prayer. He gave charity in prayer and was praised by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, loved his salah. Once he was asked by an individual about the meaning of the actions of prayer. Imam Ali alayhi salam replied, "Your takbir means Allah is above being described." In ruku' after a while he states, "When you extend your neck, it means I'm willing to be beheaded because of my faith." When you raise your head after ruku', you testify that Allah is the one who has brought us into existence, actually hears us. In the first prostration of sujood, you think about how he created us from soil. Then raising the head means Allah is giving us life. And then the second sajda refers to being buried. When we raise our head second time, it refers to being resurrected on the day of Qiyamah, judgment. He continues describing other parts of prayer until he states, "Whomsoever does not comprehend this, their prayers are incomplete." The aftermath. After prayer, sit to reflect and perform some dhikr. Imam Ali alayhi salam recommends this. He says, "If you do so, the angels will keep praying for you and I so long as we're sitting on the prayer mat." In several narrations, Imam Ali alayhi salam recommends, for example, the recitation of Ayatul Kursi after Salah, where he states it helps in the acceptance of the prayer. And of course, it is a means by which we gain protection and blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Number 9, Salah in unity. Once in Kufa, Imam Ali alayhi salam heard about a group of people who live close to the masjid but refused to pray in congregation. He then said they should attend and take part in Salatul Jama'ah, otherwise let them turn away from us. He would emphasize this prayer of congregation, even between the husband and wife, since narrations tell us it's at least 24 times more rewarding. Number 10, the sweetness of the night. Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace and blessings be upon him, loved his night prayers. He would famously say, "I have not missed Salatul Layl since I heard the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, and his family say, Salatul Layl Noor." He even performed it during the most ferocious night in the Battle of Siffin, known as Laylatul Harir. Once someone who tried to perform Salatul Layl could not, asked Imam Ali why he couldn't. Imam said to him, "It's because the sins are stopping him from the performance of the night prayer." The commander of the faithful therefore advises us to perform night prayer because according to him, it's the health of the body, pleasure of the Lord, and the downpouring of mercy, as well as following the akhlaq of the prophets. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant us